But Odysseus was solitary. He had long lost all his companions. He was alone. Virgil here gives the same words to Aeneas, who is in a fleet with all his companions. I think part of what Virgil is doing by this reminiscence of the Odyssey is stressing Aeneas's emotional isolation here. In this speech, we see Aeneas as a private individual, anguished, longing for home, heartsick, and homesick. In the second speech that Aeneas gives in the Aeneid, he's speaking to his comrades after the storm has scattered their fleet and he and his seven ships have landed on the African shore. And here, rather than saying, oh, if only we all could have died at Troy, he says, oh, comrades, surely we're not ignorant of earlier disasters, we who have suffered things heavier than this. Our God will give an end to this as well. He tells them to bear up, to remember who they are, and to hold out for better things. He also reminds them that they are fated to make their way to Latium and found a new city. So in that speech, we see the public Aeneas heartening his companions, encouraging them, reminding them of their destiny. This is yet another crucial tension in the Aeneid, between the public Aeneas and the private Aeneas, between the leader who is destined to found Rome and the private individual who is longing for his lost home and his lost country. Aeneas's arrival in Carthage combines the two themes of yearning for the past and careful attention to the future that we also see in the two speeches I just quoted. When he arrives in Carthage, Aeneas is disguised by a cloud. His mother Venus has put a cloud around him so no one can see him until he wants them to see him. He visits a temple of Juno, and it is, of course, ironic that it is a temple of Juno, his great enemy. And there he sees a series of panels depicting the Trojan War, depicting Priam and other people from Troy. Aeneas weeps when he sees these panels, but he also takes encouragement from them. They bring him hope that he's arrived in a civilized country, and he is to some extent comforted by the fact that the story of Troy is known, that the sufferings of the Trojans have not been forgotten. So there we see Aeneas yearning for the past, looking to the past, weeping for the past. But very shortly thereafter, when Dido, queen of Carthage, arrives on the scene, we see Aeneas being cautious, careful, paying attention to the future. He waits until he is sure that Dido will be hospitable and friendly before he reveals himself to her. So once again, he yearns as a private individual for the past. As a public leader, he looks carefully towards the future. Finally, Book One introduces us to Dido herself. Her reception of the Trojans in general and of Aeneas in particular shows that she is both a gracious and hospitable host and a powerful and good leader. She is very helpful to the Trojans even before Aeneas steps out of his cloud and reveals himself. She tells them she has heard of them, that she will help them, that she will take them in. She's building her own city. She's only recently arrived in Africa and founded Carthage herself, but she is willing to help these shipwrecked wanderers. She's very well disposed to Aeneas when he does reveal himself. She's gracious, kindly, and helpful to him. And so her character is delineated for us as being very noble, very courteous, very much what a queen and leader should be. And yet, as we'll see in Book 4, as we see already by the end of Book 1, she falls drastically and tragically in love with Aeneas. But Virgil stresses for us right away in Book 1 that this is not Dido's own choice. Venus schemes to make Dido fall in love with Aeneas. Dido's passion for Aeneas is caused by a direct intervention of Venus, which forces her to fall in love with him. What Venus does is disguise her son Cupid, who is the personification of sexual desire. She disguises Cupid as Ascanius and sends Cupid to see Dido. So when Dido picks up this little boy, holds him on his lap, kisses him and caresses him, she thinks she's holding, kissing, and caressing Ascanius. She's actually holding, kissing, and caressing the force of sexuality itself. She is doomed. She hasn't got a chance. She falls utterly, irrevocably, passionately in love with Aeneas. And as we'll see when we got on to book four, this causes her downfall. In fact, it causes her death. It also causes the enmity between Aeneas' descendants and Dido's descendants. And we'll discuss book four at length in lecture number six. So, in this lecture, we've looked in some detail at the opening book of the Aeneid. There is much, much more to be said, but we've looked at some of the main points of the opening book of the Aeneid, and we've seen how several of the most important themes of the epic are set up and reiterated in the opening book. In our next lecture, we'll turn to Aeneas' own narration of the sack of Troy as he tells it to Dido and the Carthaginian court.